I think of all the sins we struggle with, perhaps one of the worst is pride. It's sort of the thing where just when you think you actually have it beaten, well, it's back again. And just when you think you don't struggle with it, that tends to be the moment in which it shows up in the most unwanted and surprising places. One preacher that I know of has a phrase that really stuck with a friend of mine, and she's told it to me a few times before. And he said, you know, whenever I get to the point that I have mastered humility, I always have to start all over again. One writer said, pride is the one disease that seems to make everyone sick except the person who has it. That said, there will be times, and perhaps there has been times, when pride is primed in your life, and no one's known it. No one's recognized it. But of course, God sees it quite clearly. And whether anyone else in the world sees or cares about those subtle notions of supremacy or those hints of haughtiness in your life is ultimately unimportant, because what really matters is that God hates it. There aren't too many things you ever read about God hating, but pride is one of them. It's a spiritual cancer, if you will. It attacks you from within, and it is most often unrecognizable until it's grown to the point that only a drastic surgery and operation will get rid of it. And it's the kind of operation that can only be performed by something that is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword and capable of discerning thoughts and intentions of the heart. It's the kind of sin you can't be rid of unless there's a spiritual surgery performed by our God using the instrument of His Word to lay us open and reveal what is really in our hearts and our minds, all for the point of making us better. We don't often treat an infection by putting a Band-Aid over it. One of my cats, for some reason, a few months ago, lit me up on the hand, and you can still see the marks of it. And I didn't really think about the whole infection thing before I put some liquid Band-Aid on that. And that stuff works better than a Band-Aid ought to work, and it seals everything in. And before I knew it, because I didn't actually treat the wound and clean it and all that stuff, I had an infection in my hand. You have to go to the source of the problem. And so often, whether we realize it or not, it is pride that hinders us in our relationships with God, our relationship with God, and our relationship with others. It's pride that keeps us from enjoying nearness with God. It's pride that keeps you from enjoying closeness with your spouse or with your parents or with your children. It's pride that keeps a person from admitting his sin before God so that he can be saved. And to suit this week's chosen metaphor, it is pride that can and will derail the strongest, most determined conductor if they forget who it is that really directs their journey. Tonight we leave the book of Daniel and come to one of my favorite stories in the Bible, that of Esther. And I invite you to go ahead and be turning to that book. The material we have for this week's VBS sets out chapters 2 through 7 for our consideration. I hope, especially for those of you who worship here regularly, you've read those chapters. Or perhaps if you're visiting with us, you've read them before. We're going to sum them up as best we can and take a few minutes to do that. But I want us to dedicate most of our time towards the last text of that excerpt. Esther is one of those books that it's one of those texts that when I come to it, I honestly don't want to preach on it. I want to read it to you and leave it alone, but you're not paying me to read to you, so we're going to have a lesson on this text. But it's just fantastic, and if you've ever sat and just read through it, it really is all you need. It is tremendous. It's one of those stories that ought to be a movie by now, except for the fact that a movie would probably cheapen its impact. It's just fantastic. And so as we have endeavored to do at the start of each study this week, I want us to begin by providing a bit of setting, and in so doing, we're going to summarize all of the chapters that precede where we'll end up landing in chapters 6 and 7. We're going to talk about pride this evening because, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to stay on track by thinking of others, a good way to get off track is to think of yourself. And so that's the angle at which we'll approach this study this evening. In the first three chapters of Esther, we find that King Ahasuerus is the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire. And to make a longer story very short, through his own foolishness and drunkenness, he has divorced his wife, Vashti. This, in turn, leads to him choosing a new wife by means of essentially a long line of one-night stands with each of his new concubines. And one of those concubines is Esther, a young girl who's been raised by either her older cousin or uncle, Mordecai. And because of her beauty and her grace, which we will see clearly throughout the next few chapters, she is chosen to be the new queen. As for Mordecai, it seems he holds some kind of position in the king's gate. Not entirely sure. There are a lot of details that are left out of this account. But somehow, where he sits in the position he has gives him access to Esther and the transpiring events of the court. And so he keeps himself informed of how she's doing. And he'll also use her position to pass along very important information, most notably and relevant to our story, an assassination plot that two of his co-workers are putting together. For some reason, though, after he saves the king's life by relaying that information, no reward is dealt to him, and that'll come up later on. When you expect good things to begin happening for these two Jews, Esther and Mordecai, instead, the villain of our story makes his appearance in the form of Haman, an Agagite, who is elevated to the second highest position in the kingdom. Before too long, he's given the signet ring of the king, he becomes the hand of the king, and by command of the king, he's to be bowed down to and revered and essentially worshipped wherever he goes. Again, for something of an unknown reason, Mordecai doesn't actually obey this command. Everyone else, when Haman comes by, falls on the ground in his presence. Mordecai continues with whatever he's doing. If he's sitting, he's sitting. If he's standing, he stands. Haman might as well not be there. And when you have everyone else jockeying for recognition, he ignores Haman. Haman is pointless as far as Mordecai is concerned. And there is nothing more that's going to aggravate this man who determines himself to be of deep importance than that. When Haman learns of Mordecai's insubordination, as far as he's concerned, he's outraged. He determines that this Jew is going to die, and all of his countrymen with him, for the simple displeasure he's caused me. Haman's pride is so bloated by his success and so wounded by this one man that dealing with him alone is insufficient. Only the genocide of an entire people is the thing that will soothe his bruised ego. And so Haman cunningly gets the king's permission to write a royal edict. It's sanctioned by the king that on a particular day, only months away, all of the people of the kingdom will be allowed and encouraged to slaughter the Jews. And Haman is so committed to the success of this plan that he finances it himself in the form of a tremendous bribe to King Ahasuerus. Chapter 3 then ends by telling us that messengers are sent throughout the empire. They're posting notices. They're communicating to the people what was about to take place. And it is a very odd occurrence, and I'm not entirely sure I understand all the details and the ins and outs of what goes on with some of these interactions and these actions. But everyone is getting ready for a day in which the Jews are going to be eradicated. And so you come to chapter 4, where Mordecai sets about disrupting Haman's plot. He sends word to Esther, the queen. He tells her what has happened, what will soon happen, and that she must do something about it. She must speak to the king. But in Persia, if you go before the king without him summoning you, it's very likely he's going to take it as a slap at his authority, and he's going to execute you for the offense. And Esther knows that following her former guardian and pseudo-parent's instruction is going to get her killed. And so she tells Mordecai as much. I can't do this thing. You've got to understand what this will mean for me. I'll die. And that's when Mordecai responds with some of my favorite lines from Esther, and honestly, the whole Bible. Someone please read for us verses 13 and 14 of Esther chapter 4, preferably from a modern version.
Verses 13 and 14.
And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?"
As you read the story of Esther and you pass on to the next few chapters and you watch how Esther, when she does decide that she will go ahead and act, you watch how she handles herself, and especially when she speaks with the king, she is a master when it comes to humility and grace when need be. And you don't get that from nowhere. I suspect Esther was a very humble woman to begin with. And I think that says something to us. I have a different direction that I want to take most of this talk, but for just a moment, about Esther. When it came down to one final thing, her life, and of course, if there is one final thing, that's a pretty impressive final thing. But when it came down to that, that was a bit too much. And I can't just sit up here on some kind of pedestal and say, oh, shame on her, because I wonder how I would have done in the same circumstance. But when we're called to think of others, we must ultimately understand that that includes everything that we can possibly give of ourselves. And of course, we have one supreme example in all of that. Mordecai says to Esther, "You're worried about your life. God's people need you. And to paraphrase, if you seek to save your life, be sure you'll lose it anyway. And after all of that, God is faithful. He'll find another way to preserve his covenant people." And I love the faith of Mordecai in that. But he goes on to say, who knows if God has not brought you to this remarkable position just so that you can be the means of that deliverance. That wonderful line, for just such a time as this. There are several characters in the Bible that I hope to meet one great day. Mordecai is definitely on the list. That kind of wisdom. And so we come to chapters 5 and 6. Chapter 5 is a lot of setup for what takes place in chapters 6 and 7. It's fascinating, but we're going to move through it a little bit quicker. You see in Esther the wisdom and the grace that won her the king's favor initially, and that will gain her the victory ultimately. But in chapter 6, you come to our real discussion and lesson for the evening. Last night, in the final moments of our discussion, we saw a contrast of characters. When the stone was rolled away from the lion's den, there sits Daniel, calm and collected and preserved by his God. Darius, on the other hand, he's been a nervous wreck the entire evening. He lacks the faith in God that so steadily keeps Daniel on track. And in this story, in the book of Esther, you see another contrast of characters. There are honestly several that you can choose. And you could just about as easily go with Haman versus almost everybody else in the story. But I want us to look at Haman and his pride in comparison with those who fell him. Esther and Mordecai. So as we're talking about this subject of pride and staying on track by thinking of others instead of ourselves, I want to make two simple observations for you. The first observation is actually going to step on my own toes for tomorrow night a bit. And the observation is that those who struggle with pride must choose their friends carefully. In chapter 5, King Ahasuerus and Haman have been invited as Queen Esther's sole dinner guests to a feast she's put on. And Haman is just elated. Nobody's been invited but me. And verse 9 of that chapter talks about him going home that day joyful and with a glad heart. He is on cloud 9. But something happens along the way that really changes his mood and just ruins his day almost. He runs into Mordecai. He runs into that despicable Jew who refuses to bow down to me and show me the reverence I deserve. And for the moment, he's just livid at what he has to put up with this man. He ends up keeping his cool. He continues on home. And when he gets back, he begins bragging to his friends and his family about all of his accomplishments, about how the queen has chosen him as her guest, which is, of course, a very great honor. But Haman wants everyone to know. But even with all of that, he's still not content. He goes on to conclude, none of these great accomplishments, all of my promotions, my success, the household I have, all of my children, all of my wealth, even this great dinner with the queen, all of this, none of this is worth anything to me so long as Mordecai sits and breathes in those gates. And so it's at this point that Haman's friends, and they're not mentioned at this point, they will be mentioned later, his wise men, they have some advice for him. When you think about his wise men, I don't know if you've ever seen TV shows with kings, and they have that council that's very close to them, their most trusted advisors. They're the ones the king promotes to the most intimate service and personal service and counsel that he possibly can. They eat at table with him from time to time. They are the ones he asks when he has a question. And usually they're supposed to be pretty bright people. And so Haman asks his friends and he asks his wise men what he ought to do about this, or he's talking about all of this, and they encourage him, as I suspect you remember, to have Mordecai killed. Go get the king's permission to do this, but have him killed. And that's what Haman is on the way to ask the king when we find him in chapter 6. And we'll come to chapter 6 in just a moment. But think about that. Isn't it fantastic advice they give him? You've got a problem, he's giving you grief, kill him. Kill him. What kind of counsel is that? It's exactly the kind that friends like this will give. I doubt any of us have ever had a friend counsel us to kill someone. I hope not. But I hope you see the point. Rather than trying to reason Haman or help him deal with the problem, they give him what he wants to hear. And instead of telling him what he needs to hear, that he's got to chill out this big, fat, swelling head he's growing, they give him the kind of support that's only going to feed his pride. Solomon's son Rehoboam had a similar problem. When Solomon dies, the people of Israel and Judah meet together and they put a plea before Rehoboam for relief from the taxes and work assignments and the heavy burden that Solomon had put on them as he was building this kingdom. They need a break. And so Rehoboam calls a team of counselors together who had served with his father, old wise men, experienced men. They advise him to give the people some relief. They say that'll not only help the people out and make them actually want to work harder for you, but that'll make them love you by helping them out this way. And then once they've actually advised him, he calls together a group of his buddies that are all his age, and they feed his pride. They counsel him to increase the people's burdens. Show them just how strong you are. Don't seek their love. Don't seek their admiration. Let them know how fierce and tough and powerful Rehoboam, our friend, the one we hope that will promote us, how you really are. And they don't help him at all. They feed his pride. He follows that, and it ends up costing him a united kingdom. If you struggle with pride to any degree, you must demonstrate wisdom in choosing those with whom you'll associate. The people who stroke our egos and feed our pride, the people who tell us how great we are and how the world can't get along without us, they do nothing but bring us down. And I think we need to remember two things as we think about our associations. For starters, those people who tell us how indispensable we are, they're lying. They're lying. On the one side of the coin, we've been purchased by the blood of Christ. And we are of value to our God. He knows the numbers of the hairs on our head. We have value that way. But on the other side of things, keeping the balance, if there's one thing we don't like to admit about ourselves, it is that as soon as we are gone from some position or place in life, there is someone else, if not many others, standing in line to take our place. I believe God can work great things through each of us. And we are important in as much as we are serving Him. And that really is the ultimate answer and key to all of this. But we need to understand, I am not God's gift to the workplace. I am not God's gift to the church where I serve. I hope I will be of benefit to them, but I'm not, you know, the be-all, end-all. I'm not God's gift to my marriage. I'm not God's gift to the kingdom of God. Every position that I hold in this life is a position of privilege, which I hold by the grace of God. And I think we ought to approach them that way. There have been people who try to hurt the church by refusing to serve in some capacity, refusing to give, or whatever it might be, and they end up eventually leaving if they don't get their way enough, thinking that the church is not going to get along without them. Most regrettably, most often, the church is usually better off once a person with that attitude has gone. The success of the church doesn't rest on you or me or anyone else, which is not to say we aren't important and ought to do every bit that we can, but our success depends on God. And what's more, He will accomplish His will with or without us, as Mordecai tells Esther. And I love that confidence. And there really are, you've got to keep it balanced. This is not a contradiction in terms. Who knows if God hasn't put you here to serve this great purpose? But understand, if you don't, He'll find another way. But again, talking about personal associations, we have to choose them carefully. Iron sharpeneth iron. It's only a fool who's going to surround himself with people who tell him mostly what he likes to hear. Now, which is not to say you don't need to hear compliments, you don't need to hear what you are doing well, but if you surround yourself with people who are just enamored with you and that's it, it's very easy to lose perspective. Sometimes the best thing you can do for yourself is surround yourself with people who will knock you down a peg every now and then, who aren't so thoroughly impressed with you, who will tell you what you don't want to hear, who will straightly shoot the truth at you because they don't care about your pride or your ego. They love you, but they love God more than you. And so perhaps we take a quick inventory of our friends. We think about those to whom we turn when we need counsel. Are they feeding our egos? Or are they serving us by keeping us in our place before our God? And secondly, the reason we're talking about, again, being staying on track by thinking of others is because those who don't, those who struggle with pride, they will be derailed in their lives. They have nowhere to go but down. In chapter 6, the king calls Haman in and he asks him a simple question. What should I do for the man I'd like to honor? If you've been reading the text, in chapter 6, King Ahasuerus has actually been up all night reading because he couldn't fall asleep. And during the course of that reading, it just so happens. And that phrase pops up every now and then in this book. It just so happens. And none of this just so happens. But it says it just so happens that he reads about Mordecai. And he reads about what he did in sparing his life. And somehow this king has completely forgotten to reward the man who saved his life from that plot. And so he's determined that he's going to do something for him when he finds out that nothing's been done for him. And right as he's thinking about all of that, Haman is in the court waiting to be called in. And so he says, come on in. And that's when Ahasuerus says to Haman, what should I do for the man I'd like to honor? And Haman, boy, he must be talking about me. Who could the king possibly wish to honor more than me. And it's remarkable that he can say this. Who would he want to honor more than his hand? And so he begins to describe all the recognition that ought to be given, and he's telling the king all about this, and he's just, you know, he can't help but think about what a wonderful place of privilege he's risen to, and considering that, boy, this is what I'd do. I'd bring a robe that the king has worn and put it on him. I'd bring one of the king's rings and put that on his hand. And I'd bring the king's horse and allow him to ride that while one of the king's princes runs ahead shouting, "This is what happens to the man the king desires to honor." It really is incredible to me that Haman has himself in mind as he's suggesting all of these things. You know, I'm second in command, but quite honestly, I think if you're going to honor me, the only thing fitting is to give me everything but the throne for a day. Make me look like you. And you can see him as he's saying all of this to the king, and he's gloating and he's basking in his own greatness. And the king says, "Haman, that's a fantastic idea. Now I want you to go and do everything that you've just said to Mordecai, the Jew." It's a fantastic turn of events. Again, this ought to be a movie. King Ahasuerus and Haman have come together that morning with the same man on their minds. The king wants to honor him. Haman wants to have him killed. Haman comes with death and destruction on his mind, wanting to kill a man who thinks not of himself but for his people, for others, and who would not worship a man who is engaging in more self-worship than perhaps even the king. And as the Bible promises us elsewhere, a man's pride shall bring him low, but honor shall uphold the humble in spirit. And that's what happens. When you lift yourself up in pride, and when you think you've arrived at the top, and you get to thinking, "I'm the best and I'm the brightest," you're out of options. There's nowhere else for you to go but down. One writer said, "You've been lifted as high as you can go because your pride makes God so sick that he's not going to lift you higher." And I like that. I like that idea. Proverbs 6, verse 16 through 17, "These six things does the Lord hate. Yes, seven are an abomination unto him," and it starts out a proud look. Proverbs 11, verse 2, "When pride comes, then comes shame." Proverbs 15, verse 25, "The Lord shall destroy the house of the proud." Proverbs 16, verse 5, "Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord." And in James 4, verse 6, "God resists the proud." No matter what it is, there is no place for pride in our life. Only the preference of others. When all is said and done, Haman hurries home. His head's covered. He's in shame and he's in grief. He is mourning because he's fallen so far. At least he thinks he has. I wonder what would have happened if he would have just, you know, allowed Mordecai his moment and let the battle drop there. But he presses the issue. Of course, Esther, on her side of things, she has to continue to oppose him, otherwise her people will die. But I wonder if Haman might have been able to survive. But at this point, he's fallen so far, and it's so sad because he's not done falling. This will cost him his life. Peter writes, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you." One of two things are going to happen in relation to any pride that might exist in our life. Number one, we can recognize it, repent of it. and humble ourselves before the Lord. The second alternative is we can ignore that sin of pride and wait for God to deal with it. But we've got to understand one way or another, we are going to be humbled. And if we desire to stay on the track that leads to heaven, we must set about a course that serves Him and serves others. We must prefer others over ourselves. We must think of others. That's the course we must choose. Finish just a little bit early. So I suppose we can go ahead and open it up to the floor and have plenty of time this evening for comments and questions. So if anybody would like, go ahead. Don't tell me on the night we've got all sorts of time for it. We don't have any questions.
Haman's wife in his court, his wise man, would tell him to build this hanging. Mm-hmm. But once he got the king needed that he had to honor Mordecai, then they recognized what was going on and said, if he's a Jew, they're not going to make it. So they switched their thoughts right away. But Haman's caught up in it.
There's so much within this story that I wish the writer would have included a little bit more. When his family concludes, listen, if he's a Jew along with them, then you can't win this battle. Where was this advice earlier when he decides that he wants to wipe all of them out? And I wonder what it is that has finally caused them to remember perhaps some of the stories they heard growing up as children from time to time about this old kingdom called Israel and the Jews there, and the God that they claim to serve named Yahweh. I wonder what brings them to the point where they give this advice. You would have expected it, you know, where was this information yesterday when Haman really needs to hear it? It's fascinating that they're the ones who make this admission. There's so much about this book that we've left out. And so much about it that it is worthy of comment. So if there's any verse or something we didn't note and you'd like for us to at least consider it, or you've got a question about it, please feel free. Go right ahead and ask. Or if you have other points or questions.
This edict of the king, where he could have canceled, similar to the edict of Daniel, when he gave the edict of the king, he cannot cancel.
Yes, and so what they have to do is actually send a second edict that says the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And so you can take up arms and you can fight on this day as opposed to being able to take away the previous edict. And lo and behold, fear for the Jews sweeps the people. Again, I see God's providence in that as well. And that's how they are able to defeat this plot. And not only save their lives, but remove those who've been a threat and a source of persecution and oppression from wherever they happen to live throughout this massive region. Okay. Anybody else? Yes, and then there.
All the way in the back.
In 1 Samuel 15, the God gave instructions to Saul to destroy the Amalekites, I think.
Yes.
Was Haman and sending all those people that he didn't destroy, being an Amalekite?
An Amalekite? We're talking of the Amalekites? Do you mean because of... You mean because of Agag? I don't know. Does anybody know?
Yes, indeed.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
He is?
And that was another reason that he hated the Jews. At least that's...
Okay, for the one who confirmed...
Do you know where that information comes from?
I don't know one way or the other, I'm just asking.
Yes, he is in fact, he is a descendant of that gentleman. I know, when I studied that, it was part of the historical background.
Okay.
To the world.
There wouldn't happen to be a verse that...
Would there?
Just world history?
It's history.
Okay.
It just referenced the chapter when Saul didn't kill them all, then he left the one guy, and then he took Samuel later on to destroy the king, and that this young man was the descendant.
Eventually on down. We have a lot of
like that within that ancient world where they remember who they didn't like, you know, generations past, so that would be possible. I don't know anything about it, though. And
Mordecai gave for not bowing down. He said, I'm a Jew, I'm not going to bow down.
Okay, are you reading the text in verse 10 there, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, as in Hammedatha was the enemy of the Jews?
Chapter 9, verse 24 of Esther.
See, I think that comment, the enemy of the Jews, is just referring to Haman, not actually his father. At least that would be my reading of the text. It's possible I'm wrong.
I'm wondering, in verse 9, chapter 9, verse 13 through 15, okay. The king asked Esther, was there anything else that she wanted? And she asked for another day. I was wondering why.
It seems on this first day they're only able to accomplish so much. You look back up into verses 6 through 10, and it says that they kill the 10 sons of Haman. But obviously, as you read on further down, they need this second day to actually kill them. So they capture them, and they're going to kill them. And
yeah, you'll see Hebrew writers
do this sometimes. They'll essentially sum up what's taking place, and then they go on and explain it. And we read it like it's, you know, a succession of events. But they've actually backed up unbeknownst to us and started to clarify what they're talking about. I do find it interesting, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, that Purim, I'm not exactly sure how they say it, is still a holiday that the Jews observe today. And it's because of this salvation from God on the 14th day, or excuse me, the 13th and the 14th day. And I know for a long time they actually observed both. I don't know if they just observe one these days. I'm not sure, but it's still a holiday for them. And from what I understand, they'll gather together at temple and read this whole account every time that day comes around. I think it's often in March, but their calendar changes a lot, so I'm not sure if it stays in March. Anybody else? About five more minutes?
One of the important things, reminders from Esther for me, is that as Christians, we need to love truth in any form. And so that should flow over into our choice of friends. That's where I agree with you, and I know many of us have lost friends because we've told the truth, and that's fine as far as I'm concerned. So we need to love truth in any form, and if we're going to be dishing it out, we must also be able to receive it. So, yeah, basically that's it. There was something else that I forgot.
Do you read much ancient history?
Only one.
Yeah. During the in the book of Esther itself, Ahasuerus, who was known by the Greeks as Xerxes,
or Artaxerxes,
or a few other people. I thought about mentioning that, but I can't determine it.
Okay. In any event, I mean, it's or a derivative of the name Xerxes, whatever. He seems, for the most part, quite sane in this book. Now, if you compare it with his behavior, like during the Greco-Persian Wars, it seems like it's almost a different person, but it is the same king.
I think the traditional identity for Ahasuerus is Xerxes. There's a tremendous amount of debate about that, and so I wasn't going to try to talk about it here because it's just difficult to determine. But if you look at most, I believe, 19th century commentaries, they're all determined it's Xerxes. And now you've got some who differ with that. But if it is Xerxes, in between chapters 1 and 2, where it mentions after all of this has gone on with Vashti, that he remembers her once his anger has abated, there's about 4 years that's taken place in between chapters 1 and 2, and he's gone and actually tried to battle with the Greeks, and he's had a miserable time of it. He's been defeated. And so he comes home, and now he really wishes he had a queen around him. And that's when this process begins. That actually takes quite a while to find a young woman out of this harem of concubines to be his wife. Yes, it is a fascinating study looking back at Xerxes and what he does, or any of the other possibilities for the identity of Ahasuerus.
In any of your commentaries about how old he's supposed to be at the time this takes place?
No, and I don't know what I'd be able to do with it anyway, in as much as they're not sure it's even that one person. It's very difficult. I don't know how they try to keep it all straight. I was reading about it and just getting confused. So finally I said, we're not talking about that tonight.
I believe that Xerxes and Artaxerxes were interchangeable real names, but only one name.
I think that's another suggestion. I think you have, if I remember correctly,
a couple of Xerxes, and then there was an Artaxerxes, and maybe it was a bit interchangeable, maybe it was an entirely different person. Maybe it was someone with a crazy different name, and maybe it was a family name in some cases, and all sorts of stuff. It was.
And I believe that's why the Book of Esther starts out saying, this is the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Egypt. So there are multiple kings by this name, and the beginning of Esther, at least for those people at that time, provides the information to identify which king this is.
Is Xerxes the most common theory about who we're talking about here? Then what you've got is the Persian name adapted into Hebrew, adapted into Greek, and I think on into Latin, and all the way west into English, finally. And so it's changed many forms. But yes, the most popular idea seems to be Xerxes, and this is just a variation of his name.
Is that when you look at the name Xerxes, which is the Greek, in Wikipedia, it has the actual Persian translation of that. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be preparing a Bible class on this, and I was flying home from a business trip, and I happened to sit next to a man who had a very interesting accent. I said, you've got a very interesting accent. Where are you from? He said, oh, I'm from Persia. I said, really? Did you know that a name of one of your kings is in the Bible? He says, really, who's that? I said, well, here, let me show you. I don't know Persian, so could you pronounce this name for me? And he said, Ahasuerus was the Persian for the name Xerxes.
Mm-hmm. That's the Persian for it, or that's just how he pronounced it?
Greek is when you translate that into Persian, whatever those weird letters were, I asked him how you pronounce that, and his answer was
Ahasuerus. Are you sure the Persian
letters?
Yes.
Oh. The Wikipedia I looked at didn't make it seem like it was transmitted that cleanly. That's nice to know. And I believe we had one more. Did you have one more thing to say?
I had a question. Okay. I said that, so, because when I read Esther, I get the impression that the ladies just lined up and he said, okay, I like that one. You're actually saying that he had intercourse or he had relations with them. You said one night stand. Is that one night stand as we know it today?
Chapter 2, it talks about them being prepared for a year. With myrrh and spices and all sorts of different things. And then a lady will go into him in the evening and she will leave in the morning and return to the second harem. That sounds like only one thing to me, which sounds vulgar and incredible that you would see this of Esther, but let's not forget how many concubines Solomon had. And I doubt very much that those were just platonic concubines.
So,
deal with polygamy in that day. I think that's an issue here within this text as well. I could be wrong on that. There's a lot about the custom here. I don't know as a 21st century American, but when you talk about her going in the evening and leaving in the morning, I don't think they're just talking. So, anybody else?
You mean, is that some kind of idiom for anything? Oh, I think just went into his chambers and in the morning she left. So she goes into his chambers, and I'm assuming, you know, if you're going into the king's chambers as a lady, he's considering for his wife. There's one main purpose in that. I'd love to be wrong, especially considering what that says about us.
In that day. Yeah. All right. Thank you.